Thanks for downloading this IMSA Radio podcast. It's for personal use only and must not be broadcast, reproduced, or used in any form without permission.
Tell your friends they can get their own copy by visiting IMSAradio.com or search for IMSA Radio wherever they get their podcasts.
Fabulous entertainment being delivered by Mauro Engel and Daniel Serra, and they've got to be careful, along with scrapping very closely indeed, not to be delaying themselves too much so that Jan Halen can then be a part of this battle. He's about 7 seconds away, so incredibly, despite the closeness of the battle at GT Daytona, they're not losing a great deal of time, able to punch out 1 minute 46 0.7 for Engel, a 146.8 for Serra. And
what positions again?
Last time around, they have. I know. That's what's momentarily confusing me. Now, what I don't know is whether the Ferrari properly established itself as the lead. There was some contact that time through, and that was a slight touch from Mauro Engel to ensure the Ferrari did not take the position, and that's really put Daniel Serra on the back foot. But that's the type of contact, Joe Bradley, joining me in the Hagerty Global Broadcast Centre, that will be reviewed, I'm sure, by race control.
Yeah, definitely. It looks like they ran out of real estate, didn't it? You know what? I'm going to say this. I'm going to throw this out. It's probably the hardest piece of racetrack in the world, turn one here at Daytona. You're coming off the banking. You're turning and braking at the same time from maximum speed. It's the run all the way from the bus stop chicane on the back straight, all the way around NASCAR's speedway turns 3, turn 4, and down towards the tri-oval. And then as you're coming off the tri-oval, you are trying to control the car and modulate the brake and scrub off the speed so you can actually turn in. Let's add into that mix that you've got a car alongside doing exactly the same. And that was just a prime example where both cars are just absolutely trying to make that corner and just basically ran out of racing room for one another. They've had a mild contact. Hopefully, Johnny, that contact won't have too much of a detrimental effect, and we'll continue to see this. My concern, if I was on the wall for any of these, either the Mercedes or the Ferrari, would be just how much those drivers are taking out of those tyres by maintaining this pace and actually racing one another.
Yeah. And, I don't think Mauro Engel is necessarily the character type to say, in this phase of the race, Daniel Serra is slightly quicker than me. I'm going to let him go, because the all-important thing is that you hang on to the lead. Lead lap, yes, most important, but class lead, where possible, hang on to it. And what he has provided with, I'm sure, unintentional contact at turn one, is just a little bit of breathing space now, to the tune of 0.6 of a second. And Daniel Serra, having worked incredibly hard, A, to reel the Mercedes in, and then B, to get possibly three bites at the cherry there, coming out of Speedway turn four. He'd done it on sequential laps, put the Ferrari in a cracking position. And clearly, a top-end poke in that Ferrari is mighty compared to the Mercedes. You've got the draft as well that you should factor into it, but it's the ability to gobble up the mileage coming out of the bus stop chicane and through Speedway turns 3 and 4, and the Ferrari just seems to be slightly sweeter towards the end of each of those laps, and he was able to get fully alongside and fully in front, albeit for a short period of time, of the Mercedes. But then it was a question of whether he could get the Ferrari down to the inside line to take the apex at turn two, and Engel on his inside was never going to make that easy. So 0.5 of a second is currently the margin, Engel to Serra. Then this 7 second gap back to Jan Halen, who has in turn a 5 second cushion on Corey Lewis to the Paul Miller Racing Lamborghini Huracan. Matt Campbell in the Pfaff Motorsport Porsche is fifth, and still going strongly in sixth place is the Gradient Racing Run Sun Energy One Mercedes of formerly Kenny Habbour, the man that we had on here on the RS2 IMSA Radio a short time ago, but now being driven by his co-driver Mikael Grenier, with a certain Lucas Stoltz and Raffaele Marchiello still to come in the 75. They'll be working out when to apply those drivers in the remaining hours. pretty close between Kevin Magnussen and Dane Cameron as more mechanics prepare themselves down in pit road. So the 10 car not very far away from a pit stop. Very impressive indeed. Some press-ups going on as a part of the warm-up down at Wayne Taylor Racing and the Konica Minolta outfit. So Elio Castroneves pitted, that car has pitted in total 27 times and he's got 27 laps on the stint. This has been a long run, Joe Bradley. There was the tail end of the... Oh no, beg pardon, I needed to scroll across a little bit further to tell me that Elio's now into his next stint of 5 laps. So maybe that was just a bit of down training from Konica Minolta and their crew, because they've already performed that 27th pit stop, and it'll be another half an hour or so before the car is back in again. But Castroneves, on the face of it, 26 laps looks a very long one, but as I say, that included the tail end of the previous caution as well, Joe. We're up to just over 40 minutes of this current green flag run.
I think I'm back, and Johnny.
Aha! Here is Joe Bradley. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I was just saying, Johnny, that we talk a lot to the drivers and we talk a lot about the drivers and the physicality and the exertion that the drivers go through. But endurance racing is also very, very physical and exertive on crew members. I mean, try being a crew member. The idea of being your crewing a race car is you want long periods while the car is out on track and going round and round and doing what it's supposed to do, and then you get bursts of intensity. The car comes in the pit lane, you've got to get the job right, you've got to get the wheel gun on, you've got to get the tyre onto the pegs, you've got to get the roof back on, or reacting to adversity like we've seen all night, and the car coming in with a problem and having it been repaired. It's a pure team sport, endurance racing, and isn't that why we love it? Isn't that why we've fallen in love with endurance sports car racing? It's a massive, massive feat. When you get towards the checkered flag, it's an achievement just to get your car to the finish. And I coined the phrase, didn't I? A soap opera behind every garage door. Well, I suppose in IMSA racing, it's a soap opera behind every concrete piece of pit wall.
Yeah, and you can understand the annual outpouring of emotion from the whole team if you are lucky enough to be part of a squad that takes victory, no matter what class you're in. But there's also, to an extent, an outpouring of emotion if you can just get to the finish, and you might be in the middle 30s in terms of overall position, but you know, if the target at the end of the day was to get to the finish and you managed to achieve that, that is something that is just should not be underestimated to any extent. And, you know, you can have a game plan at the start of the race, but whether it will actually play out to the letter, I would argue probably not, because there's always going to be hurdles. There's always going to be something to overcome through the course of the race. And that's when you rely on the team. You know, the driver's a pretty significant part of it, but they can only steer the car in the right direction, accelerate and brake in the right points and do the overtaking. But the thinking of where the car needs to be on the racetrack at any one point, into the clear air where possible, that haul has to be done by the team. And then, of course, you've got to think about the preparation necessary ahead of such a long race as this. Not least the four free practice sessions, but also logistically getting everybody to the track, particularly in the current climate, with all the necessary tools and infrastructure around you, and that there's no surprise that when the checkered flag finally is waved, all of a sudden that emotion and that fatigue catches up with one, and we've seen it year on year so many times. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of stories all unfolding at the same time up and down that pit road. And one or two heart in mouths, probably, surrounding the incident between Mauro Engel and Daniel Serra. Well, everybody involved there can breathe again, because that has been reviewed by race control and it's deemed that no further action is necessary, so called entirely as a racing incident. It delayed Daniel Serra, but it didn't put him out of the fight for the lead of the race. And he's again glued to the tailpipes of Mauro Engel. So give them a few more laps, and I reckon Serra will try exactly the same thing. He'll put out of his mind what happened previously, and it is a fresh start for the Ferrari to try and mount a challenge on the class-leading Mercedes of Mauro Engel. Jan Halen, it was 7 seconds the last time I checked. It's grown to now 9 seconds. So Jan unable to live with the speed of both Engel and Serra in the lead of GT Daytona. Corey Lewis stabilising the gap really to Jan. It's remaining at 5 seconds there or thereabouts. And Matty Campbell completes the top five in GT Daytona. In GTLM, still two Corvettes with Tommy Milner with a slight advantage over Tonio Garcia, but it's less than a second after 548 laps completed for those two Corvettes. The Rossi Competizione Ferrari is in third, ahead of the best of the BMWs for Brazilian Augusto Farfus. And in LMP2, Mathieu Vaxivière now to the pointy end. So he's got ahead of Kyle Tilley, and Tower Motorsport now lead LMP2. Here we go, Daniel Serra. I told you that he might do this, to the outside of Mauro Engel. Something like a fourth bout of deja vu for me, and he still can't get the move done, but that won't prevent him from trying. And again, at the start-finish line, Serra was scored as the race leader. The positions switch back again in favour of the German by 23 thousandths of a second. But this is going to stay nip and tuck at least to the end of this particular stint, Joe Bradley.
I really do that. Yeah, absolutely. It really is. They are so close on performance. Serra gets the Ferrari ahead across the line, across the tri-oval. But then the Mercedes has the optimum line into turn one. And that's what we see. He can brake steadier, if you like, and the car's more stable on the inside line using all the rubbered line. And here we go again. They're out onto the banking once again. And Serra will want a time getting up behind and under the rear wing of that Mercedes to use that slipstream effectively. And what we're seeing now is the Mercedes driver having to drive defensively. They're side by side into the bus stop. Not really. It's always been a dubious passing place through that very, very fast section of racetrack. Now, this is where Serra will want to try and get the drag. He's got about three car lengths in between himself and the Mercedes. And you'll see the slipstream effect come into play as they come through NASCAR 3, NASCAR 4. Or the drag down towards the tri-oval is where the slipstream effect really comes into play. And Serra moving to the right again, ahead of the Mercedes once again. But as we see the cars go into the braking area, it will be the Mercedes that once again, it's deja vu on numerous occasions, Johnny. It's the same act every time we see these cars going through and into turn one. It's the same placement, it's the same everything. Now what Daniel Serra needs to do, he needs to rethink his tactic and how he's going to get by.
Daniel Serra, who has sealed a full season in the World Endurance Championship in 4 AF Corsa and replacing Davide Rigon. So looking forward to seeing how Serra gets on with a full campaign laid out in front of him. He's done the odd round, was called in to the Bahrain 8 hours last November to replace Davide Rigon, who was busy racing GT3 cars in France. Now Daniel Serra gets a big opportunity with AF Corsa. Well, he's doing his fans no injustice at all here and backing up, really, AF Corsa's decision to seal him into the WEC, because to be able to take the fight as he is doing to Mauro Engel is mightily impressive. But I think I agree with Joe in that he maybe has to just start to think about a different way of doing this, because 4 or 5 times he's had an attempt around the outside of the tri-oval and into turn one and just can't make it stick. I would argue he only needs maybe a couple more inches of an advantage and then he should be able to slice across the nose of the Mauro Engel Mercedes. My only worry would be then what Mauro had up his sleeve in terms of a fight back. We've already seen some contact and it's quite obvious that the Munich Meister is not going to give this GT Daytona lead up without some form of a fight. But Ferrari has massive advantage coming through the tri-oval, but then Engel is perfectly within his rights to use all of the racetrack with the inside line to form that defence, and that's exactly what he does again at the start of lap 535, Joe.
How many times have you said to yourself, I only need a couple of more inches? And that's exactly what Daniel Serra's thinking. And I think what we need now is for Serra to maybe get down the left-hand side of Engel. However, Mauro Engel, he's been around the block a few times. He knows exactly what is required to overtake himself. So that's why we see when the car comes out of the bus stop chicane, he's just hugging the yellow line down low on the banking. And he sits on that yellow line and he blocks that entry into turn one.
Yeah, and time again it is happening. So maybe that thought process is echoing in the mind of Daniel Serra now. How can I start to try and fashion a different line into turn one, or maybe just do it somewhere entirely different? But I can't see the advantage anywhere else on the racetrack for that Ferrari, equal or as good as it is. I don't think he has. That's his only chance to get by, isn't it? And Engel is never going to give up the inside line.
No, and he's going to sit there and he's going to do that lap after lap after lap. And that's what we're going to see. Now, we could be in a situation here where Daniel Serra is just going through the act. He's just playing the game. Both cars on the pit lane at exactly the same time, Johnny.
So now we need to work out how long these drivers have been at the wheel and whether we're in for another dose of this for another hour-long stint or whatever these cars can do on fuel. It normally is an hour around this place in a GT Daytona car. So let's have a look. 57 in. Oh, they're virtually side by side to the pit bay as well. They would be just a pit stall apart, wouldn't they? So I'm sure there's been plenty of banter between the teams as well, shouting at a suitably social distance. Some sledging going on between Windward Racing and AF Corsa. And 30 lap stints each. Now, who was in the cars prior to Engel and Serra? I'm struggling here to track back again. It was Engel in the 57 and it was Simon Mann in the 21 car. So Sarah's fresh and good to go for another stint, and I'm sure Engel is being kept in the car here as well. Fuel's going in and the Mercedes is released marginally before the Ferrari, but to be honest, that can probably be made up by Daniel Serra.
It's the battle of the fueling there, wasn't it? Both cars off pit road at exactly the same time, John.
Yeah,
I think we've got Ross Gunn on the line.
Oh, excellent. Yeah.
Ross Gunn out of the 23, the Heart of Racing Aston Martin. Ross, hopefully you're there and you can hear me. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're good, mate.
Hello.
Your car at the moment, currently 8th in GTD. Tell me, what's the story of the race so far?
To be honest, it's been a fairly smooth race for us. We've not quite had the pace of the front guys, but we're chipping away. We had a couple of little bits of bad luck in terms of cautions and whatever, but we're still in the fight. As you know, at Daytona, anything can happen and things can change very quickly with the cautions. So we're plugging away. I think we're about a lap and a half off the lead, and the pace in the last stint didn't look too bad, so pushing on forward.
Now, we've just been watching that battle at the front of your class with the Merc and the Ferrari there, Ross. Give me a driver's perspective on that. It looks, from all intents and purposes, as though Serra is trying all he can to get by. I'm sure that's the case, but surely he's not going to risk everything in a silly move on the Merc.
Yeah, I've literally just got back.
What would you do in that situation as well?
Yeah, well, as I said, I've literally just got back to my motorhome and got the race on in front of me, and I'm watching the battle, and it looks like Serra has got a little bit more straight line speed, and he's doing everything he can to use the side draft, but Engel's defending very, very well. It's a difficult one, really. I think being with 6.5 hours still to go in the race, I think from Sarah's point of view, he just needs to stay where he is and not make any risks. And if he can save things like fuel and also brakes and potentially get it in the stops, because Engel is driving a very, very good defensive line.
That's a good point you make about managing brakes. We talk about tyre management. How much tyre management is going on? Because, you know, it's a very high-speed train, that, isn't it? But just how much are you concerned or conscious of how you're using the tyres during a stint?
For sure, you've got to be pretty careful on the outlaps. Obviously, there's no tyre warmers in IMSA, so it's very important not to destroy the surface of the tyre before you've even started the stint. For sure, you've got to be careful in the infield with the rear tyres, look after the rears and not spin at the rears in the infield. It's not a massively high deg circuit, but the first few laps on cold tyres are very, very tricky for sure, and it can catch a lot of people out.
The team this year, Ross. Your team. Sorry, go on, Johnny.
Just a very quick question. I'm going to be very brave here, Ross, and approach this topic, but I know you, so I feel like I can have a little chat about events that happened here 12 months ago for you. A certain altercation with the pit wall. Is it a case of wanting to come back to this event to really have closure on what happened in 2020 and fully move on from it?
Yeah, to be honest, it was playing on my mind a little bit before coming to this race. Obviously, for those of you that don't know, I had a bit of a mishap last year on the pit exit, a momentary lapse of concentration, and that was all that she wrote, really. That was the end of the race for us last year, which was bitterly disappointing. But this year it has been on my mind on pit exit, but it so far has, you know, stood me pretty well. Obviously, having another Aston Martin customer team here as well, they've experienced new tyres this weekend, and they've all said to me that they'll never take the mick out of me ever again, because it is very, very tough on the pit exit and also on the first line lap in the cold night time. So far so good, and I haven't had any problems, and we're looking forward to pushing forward for the rest of the race.
Good stuff. Thank you for your candor and your honesty in that reply. It's obviously been slightly on your mind. There's plenty of movement at Aston Martin at this stage. Sadly, no more factory cars in the World Endurance Championship. Where does that put you in your role with the team?
So I'm very fortunate that I've been kept on as a factory driver for this season. There's been a shift of direction in concentration of the business, so we're going to be supporting customers all over the world more and concentrating on customers more, and it's just a bit of a refocus. GT3 racing is looking very, very strong, as is GT4 racing, so I think it's a good time to support our loyal customers that we've had for the last so many years, and keep giving them full support, whether that is with engineers, drivers, or technical support back at Banbury. So we're very lucky to still be in great jobs and doing fantastic races like Daytona is.
One race I think is still absent from your CV, I'm just scanning through it now, is a trip to the Nürburgring on the Nordschleife. You must fancy that one day.
Yeah, so I've done a few VLNs. I did VLNs at the end of 2018. I did two, but I've never done the 24, and that's definitely something that I want to do very soon. It's a pretty mythical place, and certainly a place that I want to have a long future at in the years to come.
Well, there is a near enough permanent Aston Martin suite there, as I'm sure you know. So there's a facility in place. We just need some very smart Aston Martin cars to return to that big old 24-hour race. We've missed them in recent years, but maybe with, obviously, Formula One is the priority within Aston, but it would be great to have some GT3 cars thundering around the ring once again, and maybe you can be part of it. So what's the plan for the rest of the race? I'm assuming you're down as one of the finishing drivers?
I will be back in the car towards the end of the race. Not 100% sure when, but I've still got a good few stints in me left yet. So at the moment, I'm just going to have a relax, some drink, and then come back later.
Do you feel across your stints the track's changing a great deal? I mean, that's another amazing thing about a 24-hour race is that the track condition is very fluid, particularly night and then back into day.
Yeah, for sure. It does make a big difference. And as I said, with the lack of tyre warmers here, the nights are very, very difficult and it does change the balance. And that's, one of the things that I've been trying to work out during this race, actually, is trying to work different ends of the car that need it more than in previous stints because of the temperature drop. So the balance is changing quite a lot, and we're working on that as we speak. But things are pretty good so far, and there is a big change for sure in the track grip throughout the race. Obviously, it's rubbering in, but at the same time, the cars are also wearing out as well, which is why sometimes you might not always see fastest laps coming towards the end of the race. And I think the actual fastest lap in GTD was set at the start when everything is fresh. But the track for sure is definitely gripping up nicely at the moment.
Really good intel there, Ross. Thank you so much for taking the opportunity or taking the time out of your downtime to speak to us. We very much appreciate it. And with many fans of Aston Martin, of course, tuned into RS2 IMSA Radio as well. Great stuff. Thanks, Ross.
Cheers. Thank you. Take care.
So we wish Ross very well, very much well for the remaining stint that he has to do. The fastest lap that he talks about in the category, actually produced by the Scuderia Corsa Ferrari, which is down in 10th position, the number 63 Ferrari, which has at the wheel at the moment Ed Jones. But as Ross makes the point, that lap was set many, many hours ago, probably in clear air for the GT Daytona cars. A 145.724 is still the best lap within that category. But Mauro Engel's car has done a 146.1, and Mauro able to produce pretty close to that, actually, in the current conditions. Into pit road, Joe Bradley. VP Racing Fuels pit and paddock report now for Pipo Durrani. This will be his 31st stop to match his race number.
And I'm being told by the team that I need to check my hearing because my assessment on the strange exhaust note has been denied. Well, I'm standing by my first assessment, and I do think that car has got a problem with the exhaust. However, it doesn't seem to be any detriment. We do know that there was concerns about the some rearranged underfloor on that car, but that has sort of manifested in no issues. And there's no doubt about it that when that car goes by, it's got a different exhaust than the other Cadillacs. Again, it doesn't seem to be to the detriment of the car's performance in the 31. Nasr now at the wheel of that wheel and engineering car, and he is currently in fifth by dint of that pit stop. And he's back out after that pit stop, Johnny, and back into this race.
Indeed so. Another half an hour of the race ticked off, and we're working our way towards the 6 hour mark, therefore. At 22 the hour, we will be there. Just a quarter of the race still to go at that point. But important just to focus on this stint in hand. Felipe Nasr then taking charge of the 31 car. I suppose that is really the staple response, the expected reply from the team. They're never going to admit that something's wrong with the car or sounding slightly strange and claim that that's exactly how it's intended to sound.
Tinkers, Johnny. Of course, the teams are listening and they don't want to give anything away. However, I'm pretty sure the teams would have heard that exhaust note and be fully aware of what what's going on with the 31. They're always monitoring your competitors up and down the pit lane. You're looking at their cars as they come in the pits. I mean, even at this stage, with just under 6.5 hours to go, there's still a chance that, you know, you want to try and optimise your position to the detriment of the other competitors. That's competitive sport, isn't it? That's what racing's all about.
Yeah, quite right. And, you have one ear on the team radio, and let's hope another ear on RS2 IMSA radio to get a fair reflection on what's happening up and down the order, and namely in your class. But it's also important to know, for example, where the GT Daytona lead scrap is, because they're likely to be two abreast virtually all the way around the lap, and therefore difficult to lap once you get to them in a big DPI or LMP2. Onto pit road also is Dane Cameron. Actually, a relatively clear pit road for Dane on this occasion. There's one other car being serviced, which is the Matt Plum Team TGM Porsche, car number 64. And apart from that, Jimmy Johnson also heads off the main speedway and into the service area. A little bit of tyre pickup removed from the nose of the number 60 car as well, but nowhere near as bad as to need to switch the nose over. That can be removed by hand and it's sent back into the race. Windscreen tear off removed from the number 48 Ally car. Fuel still going in, looks like tyres have been done already, so it's set to go once more with Jimmy Johnson still at the wheel. Didn't see a driver disappearing back into the pit. So Jimmy keen for another 22 odd lap stint. And he'll return in something like fifth position when this all unwinds itself. And the race leader is in as well. And the Konica Minolta outfit couldn't have an easier run into pit road. They are in pit stall number one, Joe, right next door to the two Corvettes, and it's the easiest entry therefore to the team. They've got to remember they've got a different car though this year, so no longer are they looking for a Cadillac to appear out of Speedway Turn 4, but it's a very sort of stealth-like looking Acura with that unique nose arrangement with the horizontal strip across from left to right to give it a bit of a styling cue from a street Acura.
Yeah, very much distinctive nose that the team will be looking at, but also the Konica Minolta livery on the Windtailer Racing car has always had for a few years now that black livery, very distinctive out on track. That car, I believe I saw a driver change, but Helio Castroneves showing that he stayed in the car, but I'm pretty sure we saw a driver.
Yeah, don't think the car's actually
I should put that car's back
left
out.
Pit
also
lane
out
yet.
Is the 01. Sorry, Johnny, go on.
It's Alexander Rossi. There you go, Joe. So you were right. You did see a driver change, and I was incorrect. Yeah. I was incorrect with Jimmy Johnson staying at the wheel of the 48. So apologies. It's actually Simon Pagenaud taking charge of that. So quick was Simon to get on board. I'd missed it. And NASCAR legend Jimmy Johnson coming to the end of another stint. But the 48 is in contention. Same can be said for the four cars ahead of it on the road as well. The 0-1 for Chip Ganassi, the 10 for Konica Minolta and Wayne Taylor Racing, Felipe Nasr's Whelan Engineering Cadillac, and the Meyer Shank Acura for Olivier Pla. And just about all of those pit stops were carried out seamlessly. Still mightily frustrating for all those involved with Mazda Motorsports, though, Joe. They just cannot get any closer than this two-lap deficit that they've been carrying for probably 4 or 5 hours now.
I think it's the game that we're playing now, right till the flag is what we're going to see. Let's break away from this because we've got another driver to chat to, giving us another bit of insight. This time we've got Stephen McAleer on the line out of the number six, the car that's currently running third in LMP3. Stephen, hopefully you can hear me.
We're chasing him, Joe, but he's not there quite yet. Yeah. So give it another few minutes and Stephen will be there. But Joe's ready with the VP
Stephen's
Racing Fuels
and
paddock report. Obviously, obviously drivers having to juggle with their various duties when they're out of the car, and time can disappear very quickly when you have cooled off after a stint, headed back to the motorhome, and then there are various duties, particularly now we're back into firmly daylight hours for the run to the line. So we'll give Stephen another opportunity in the next few minutes to catch up. I'm interested to see what he thinks to an LMP3 car around Daytona in a 24-hour race, just about the longest race that an LMP3 car will have competed in, although there was we think the Thunder Hill event almost certainly had LMP3 cars in, and then there was a question mark as to whether LMP3s have run for this race distance at Silverstone. Now I remember a 24-hour race that was run for 50% for prototypes, but I'm pretty sure the prototypes in the 24 hours of Silverstone actually got a checkered flag after only 12 hours in that event, so therefore won't have got anywhere close to this race distance, and therefore it's probably only here and Thunderhill where the LMP3s have got their teeth into a 24-hour race. And so far three of them are doing brilliantly well. Oliver Askew for Riley Motorsports leads in the 74 car. Wayne Boyd is second for the Sean Creech Motorsport outfit, number 33, and Moritz Krantz for Mulma Motorsports America in the Duquesne DOA car, number 6, running in third. Jerome Blakemolen in the sister Riley Motorsports car is down in 31st position overall, fourth in class, more importantly. There are 10 GT Daytona cars separating Jerome from the third place car of Moritz Krantz, so it'll take a little while to work his way through that party of GT Daytona cars, and you have to think they're not necessarily going to be forward in opening the road for Chiron, so he's going to have to work hard to get through those battling cars. Ed Jones will be the first on his list, followed by Richard Westbrook and Colton Herter. So we'll try and keep tabs on that. As the class leader, Ollie Askew, working his way now out of the West Horseshoe. And speaking of LMP3s, there's been a spinner from that class at turn number 6, I make that. Car 38, which isn't one of the top three cars. It's actually Rasmus Lindt in the Performance Tech Motorsports Ligier, which is running in at 6th position in class and can now rejoin. Now, was I right in suggesting that was turn 6? Yes, up onto the high banks now to Speedway turn 1. And Rasmus Lindt is back into the race. Still chasing Stephen McAleer, so fingers crossed we will get him to air as soon as possible, as Tristan Vautier in the number 5 car returns to the racetrack. The 7th placed DPI Cadillac still a long, long way away from any of its buddies, if you like, within that division. The race started with 7 DPIs. It's most impressive and testament to the strength and reliability of the cars in that category that we've got 6 still at the sharp end of the timing screen, and just the one difficulty for the number 5, which was actually assessed as its fault. Car 5 at the time was being driven by Tristan Vautier when there was a clash with Jan Halen in the number 16 Porsche, which pitched the Wright Motorsports 911 into a spin, and there was a secondary impact. This all took place at turn number 1. And as the Porsche spun through 180 degrees, it then, in a backwards motion, T-boned the number 5 car and put the 5 behind the wall for lengthy repair work to the left-hand side side pod. That happened deep into the night. I remember when Joe was on with me here in the Haggerty Global Broadcast Centre. Jeremy Shaw was part of that portion of the broadcast as well, and will rejoin us, by the way, a little bit later on. We've got, roughly speaking, another hour and a half or so of myself, Johnny Palmer, and Joe will be keeping me company for some of that as well. At which point,
we were
John
about
Hindoff
to talk,
will take
Johnny,
over.
About
yes, Joe.
Johnny, we were about to talk about the Mazda, weren't we? and about that that damage limitation run that the car was in after losing that time very early in the race. And I was about to make a comment with regards to just how difficult a task it is. It was three laps down after that initial delay. It's now clawed that deficit back to two laps. However, this race is such an optimized 24-hour race. And what I mean by that is it's nigh on flat out for the whole 24-hour race. And you'll find that the lead cars, there's very little in it. And it's kind of the, we've mentioned this before, the leaders keep a holding pattern without overdoing it. And they're pretty much running optimized every lap, nursing the car, nursing the brakes, nursing the tires. We've heard drivers mention this. And for the Mazda Motorsports team to then pull a fast one, the only way they can really do that is by a bit of luck when it comes to pit stopping. Maybe pit stopping right on a yellow flag, just before a yellow flag period comes out, so that they soak up less time in the pits. You need something like that. You need the planets to align, and that really is a massive, massive ask. And so, you know what, team at Mazda, they've been there, they've done this before, they've got many t-shirts with regards to this situation, and they will continue running round as fast as they can and hope that the planets do align and they'll be in a position to take advantage of that very thing.
Yeah, as you say, it's one thing finding one lap to get back to the lead position, or the all-important lead lap, but then you've got to find two more. So they were doubly snookered, were Mazda Motorsports. A question, as Joe says, is waiting for the next caution, maybe getting a single lap back again, and then you've only got one more to find, and that really is a big psychological boost. It is not impossible for Mazda still to get a podium in this race, and some very unusual circumstances could even present an opportunity to win it, but they would need an awful lot of luck heading to their side, Joe.
Andy Cotton, editor of Race Car Engineering, their situation's perhaps exacerbated because the leaders have been going out of sequence with regard to their pit stop windows. So it's going to be very hard for them to read as to how to get back on and in touch with those leaders. Thanks for that, Andy.
Yeah, there's no definite right time to be pitting. I suppose early on in this race, you get that sense of a rhythm. The cars come in roughly on the same lap. If they've got two cars in the entry and they're in next door pit stalls, then they'll deliberately pit them on alternate laps. But they, early in the race, generally only are a maximum of a lap apart. But we are well away from that now in terms of the leaders. Elia Castroneves and Kevin Magnussen, to go against what I've just said, are due to pit on the next lap. However, the same lap the next time they come in. Felipe Nasr will have pitted three laps before that, I make it. And then you've got Olivier Pla and Sam Pagano on a different cycle again. They are somewhere between the two, expected in a lap prior to the race leaders. So, yes, it's awkward to judge from a Mazda Motorsports point of view. And therefore, maybe even more reason to concentrate entirely on their own race, and then just keep your fingers crossed that you can keep it neat and tidy and a little bit of luck does head your way. They're certainly due some, and their preparation for this race couldn't have been better, it seems, because Harry Tinknell was interviewed here on RS2 IMSA Radio during the night practice, a session they decided to sit the majority of out, and they did feature in FP4, but only from memory in the start of it, where they did about five laps and then parked the car. They were that confident that they'd done everything, all the job list was complete, and they were raring to go for the race, but haven't necessarily had the performance that they expected from the opening stints, and then they hit the trouble which put them laps behind. Meanwhile, out of the bus stop chicane goes Felipe Nasr in the Whelen Engineering Cadillac, running in third. And he's got Kevin Magnussen in sight for the second-placed position. And much further down the road, Alexander Rossi going very strongly in the Konica Minolta Acura. Five laps away from the 600 lap marker. That will put us back ahead of the 800 lap marker. Now, it seemed pretty obvious from about quarter distance that we weren't going to be in the ballpark to go further than we managed 12 months ago. 833 laps, the record distance, remember. But we've been sort of flirting with just slightly fewer than, and now slightly more than, 800 laps as the predicted range to reach by 3:40 this afternoon. By the way, local time just gone 25 minutes past 9 in the morning at Daytona. I make it 803 laps as the predicted mileage currently, which means 208 laps to go, but that could change at any moment. But it's getting tight now, isn't it, Joe, for second and third with Jan Magnussen. Jan Magnussen. Oh, there's that first mistake.
Oh, Kevin, that's the Magnussen. First time, Johnny.
I think it is.
That's a dollar in the jar. That's a dollar in the jar. It's only got a dollar in it, though.
I said another well-known line at the start of the race, some reference to how much time there was still to go. That's not the line, so it doesn't therefore mean another dollar in the jar. But I did terribly in terms of uttering that phrase, I think, in my opening stint. And now I've said Magnussen Senior rather than Junior, but that was always going to happen, I think. Many races I've called in the past with Sebastian Priaulx in the race and called him Andy. It's just force of habit. But I'll get there eventually. Tired minds, that's my excuse, at 9:30 in the morning.
Talking about that battle at the front of the field, let's get some absolute insight into this. I've got Renger van der Zander on the line. Renger, can you hear me?
Yeah, of course. How are you guys?
Brilliant. We're great, mate, and it's great to talk to you. We've just been speculating as to just what sort of finish we've got in store for the final 64 hours. What's it like being at the front of it and the thick of it?
I mean, it's pretty crazy, man. So far, we had so many moments where the bus stop, you get pulled off and you're supposed to get out of the bus stop. That's when you are sitting duck and people fly by. So, you know, sometimes you're lucky, sometimes you're not lucky when you're leading. So, but we've been able to get to the lead a few times, many times. So, car is running okay. I feel the Acuras are picked up, they picked up some speed overnight. So, hopefully we can have a good go at it at the end. But it's so competitive. It's very very tight and everything. And I think BYD ends up done a good job because I think there's many cars who can win this race today.
At Renger, you're no stranger to the top step of the podium at this race. When exactly, without giving too much away, when exactly do you think you guys are going to go, right, let's go for it? Is it going to be 3 hours to go, 2 hours to go, 20 minutes to go? When should we be looking out for that?
No, it's so tight that any last yellow, that's going to be the decider. So if that's with 20 minutes to go, and, you know, with 30 minutes to go, it's only a short yellow. It's not going to be a long yellow. So you better be ready for that last half hour to, you know, put the knife between the teeth and go for it. So I think, you know, to be honest, from the beginning, the get-go, people were wheelbanging and driving their asses off and taking a lot of risk already. I was kind of surprised with that. Kind of slipped back and looked at it all, and I was able to drive to the lead at that point anyway, because people were running wide and all that. But so far, it's been one big sprint race, really. So pretty cool at the same time.
You're an experienced pair of hands in endurance racing, Renger. You've got to what I can only describe as hot shots. You've got Kevin Magnussen just out of Formula One. You've got Scott Dixon, an IndyCar legend. Both drivers more familiar with sprint racing and having a very selfish attitude. How have you found these two guys to work with regards to, you know, compromising the setup, for instance? And it's a completely different sport, isn't it, endurance racing to IndyCar and Formula One?
Yeah, it is. It is different. And, you know, you don't have to tell Scott what he needs to do. And he knows exactly what to do. And he also understands the concept of team racing, you know, racing as a team. So with Ingenassi, I think anyway they look at that. You know, Chip says there's no dumb questions, for example, and that's something what brings the philosophy within the team that hey, we're here together and let's make the most out of what we have and what we can do. And I think Scott grew up in Chip Ganassi Racing, so I'm just a big fan of Scott, really. And Kevin, I think he had a dad who has been here for 22 years, so I think he told, you know, Jan told Kevin exactly how it's going here, and I think Kevin is very low ego in general, so we've been working really nicely together. It's been really good so far with them.
Kevin, Renger, is Johnny
very easy?
Sorry.
Very easy. And it's down to you that the Dutch and the Danish having very similar personality traits.
Yeah, it is. I think the Danish and the Dutch are kind of similar. They, they're not far from each other anyway. So that might be part of it. They're a little bit more Scandinavian, but I think you're right. The Dutch and the Danish are a little similar, but... yeah, it's been really good. We've only started working this week, right? So he had a baby 2 weeks ago, so he stayed away for the factory visit that we did, that I did, together with Scott. And then I met him here in Daytona, and I know Kevin from the past, so on that respect, it's already quite easy to talk with him. But you know, and the other thing is like getting kids is changing your life, as all of you know probably, but. This is something also a big topic during this weekend, of course, when he's got his kids. So it's been really nice.
Renger, it's Johnny Palmer joining Joe Bradley in the Haggerty Global Broadcast Centre here on IMSA Radio. I just wanted to ask you whether a certain thought has crossed your mind, because you look back at the overall win in 2019, your name is there. 12 months ago, you did it again. A hat-trick of wins around this place is an incredibly rare thing. Have you even begun to sort of think that might be possible, or is it best to put it out of your mind?
I mean, statistically, it's impossible, right? So, but I'm going to give it a go anyway, so let's see.
Does it add any extra pressure knowing that there's another Rolex on the line, or is it just the same as it was when you first did this race?
No, it just feels like, I don't know what's going to happen in the last 6 hours, but it just feels like there's many more cars who can win this race right now. Last year we were dominating, this year we've been really good, we've not been dominating, so I think there's many cars who can win this race right now, so it's so tight, so I think that's something what's going to make a difference, you know, so... in this year's edition, that the one who's, you have to be almost kind of lucky to win this one, you know, with the traffic and all that. But, you know, every time Scott showed up last year, we won. So he's our lucky charm.
Maybe it's as simple as that at the end of the day. Has there been a little bit of banter during race week with your old friends at Konica Minolta now that they've changed their car? But of course, you took the two titles with that team in 19 and 20.
Yeah, I'll just race them a little harder than the rest of the field, that's all.
Okay, maybe keep the conversation to a minimum. Thank you, Renger. We'll let you concentrate on the job in hand because it's a big one and you're well in this fight with K-Mag currently running in second place and only 5 seconds off the tail of Alexander Rossi. Brilliant to hear from you, though. Thank you for taking the time to chat to us here on IMSA Radio, Renger.
Same to you guys, and always a pleasure. It's always nice to hear you guys. See you later. See you at the end.
Excellent. Indeed, see you at the end, and let's hope it's a good result for Chip Ganassi Racing, although we have no favourites here on RS2 IMSA Radio, remaining entirely neutral and calling the race as it unfolds with the 10 car that I suppose you could say was the team, but not the car that Renger van der Zanden ran with 12 months ago. He's now firmly ensconced in the Chip Ganassi Racing outfit with Scott Dixon and Kevin Magnussen, the aforementioned. Felipe Nasser still running in third with Olivier Pla and Simon Pagenaud completing the top five. So, actually Tim Gray, our executive producer, up in London making the point that three wins in not necessarily sequential years is less rare, but the point is that it will be back-to-back victories. So Well, that's the nature of a hat-trick, isn't it? It's not a hat-trick in cricket unless you do it in three sequential balls. So that was my definition of hat-trick. But anyway, there we are. The BMW heads out of turn six and up onto the high banks, the 25 BMW of Team RLL, and around the outside of the 75 Sun Energy One and Gradient Racing run Mercedes. Also at the same time as GTLM overtaking GT Daytona traffic, there was a prototype that needed to nip through and into the bus stop as well. The bus stop, Joe, on paper looks to be a relatively simple run through a left and a right kink. However, you add traffic, and in that case three different classes worth of traffic, and it can be very, very hairy indeed.
It's all about race car dynamics, Johnny. It's about changing direction. It's about shifting that weight in the chassis and coming off a very high-speed piece of racetrack and then braking in a straight line, turning the car left, immediately then turning it right and then firing it out of the chicane. That's where the skill comes in for just timing that weight transference and making that transition from putting the weight on the right-hand side of the car and then transitioning to the left. That's what race car driving is all about. It's all about the middle ear. It's all about the balance. And would you believe it's all about the feel through your backside? And any race driver will tell you that. It's all about the feel in the car. You have to become as one with the car and feel its every move and feel that weight transference. And that's what makes good drivers great drivers, the ones who can do that better. And that bus stop chicane here at Daytona is perhaps, again, there's so many parts of this track that look on paper to be, well, that looks like a doddle. It's just, you know, straightforward right-hander. But, you know, even the infield hairpins are tricky because of the way the track is cambered. There's adverse camber on the outside of both of those infield hairpins. The transition out of the infield and onto the banking, very, very tricky corner just to get the maximize your acceleration. And then running down to the bus stop chicane, which started the conversation, it kind of looks like a passing place, and some people will try it there, but it's a very tricky place to pass. Not one of my favorites, and not one of favorites of many that I know. But you know what, Johnny, if it would be easy, we'd all be doing it.
Quite right. That's the voice of Joe Bradley. I'm Johnny Palmer, and we're both in the Haggerty Global Broadcast Center bringing you live coverage of the 2021 edition of the Rolex 24 of Daytona. Amazingly, the 59th time that this race has been run. And you're tuned to IMSA Radio, part of the Radio Show Limited network of channels right here on RS2. You can get in touch, remember, at IMSA Radio on social media. Make sure you use the hashtag R24 Radio, R24 Radio, and the tweets will find their way to us. The latest Mazda in-race update then sees Alexander Rossi in his Acura lead the way in car number 10, and he has a lead of 4.8 seconds over Kevin Magnussen's Chip Ganassi Racing Cadillac car 01. Third position is the Felipe Nasr Whelen Engineering Racing Cadillac for the Brazilian driver, number 31, and then Olivier Pla is fourth for the Meyershank Racing squad with Kerb Agajanian in the second of the Acuras. In fifth place, it's Simon Pagino for Ally Cadillac Racing, number 48. And the Harry Tinknell Mazda remains, now only one lap down, I notice. So the 55 car has been on the move since I last checked. Now, that might just be a quirk of the timing system. We'll allow Rossi to cross the line again, and it may revert to two laps once more. But Harry Tinknell certainly going in the right direction in terms of trying to gather that lost ground back up again. In LMP2, a bank of five cars run 7th to 11th in overall position. Mathieu Vaxivière for Tower Motorsport leads in car 8, that's an Orica, as is the Era Motorsport Kyle Tilley driven number 18, second, and Christopher Mies for Dragon Speed is third, also in an Orica 07. Then it's Sven Müller in the best of the Ligiers in LMP2, running in fourth place for car 51. GTLM has a Corvette leading and a Corvette in second for Nick Tandy and Jordan Taylor, car 4 and 3. Then it's John Edwards for the BMW Team RLL squad with the best of their M8s, third for car 24. Davide Rigon is fourth, number 62. And in fifth place, it's Timo Glock, also in a BMW for Team RLL. Oliver Askew in the LMP3 category continues to lead for Riley Motorsports. He's got a Ligier JS P320. That's car 74. Ahead of Wayne Boyd, also in a Ligier, and Moritz Krantz for Mulner Motorsports, car number 6. And in GT Daytona, Daniel Serra finally getting ahead of Mauro Engel in the AF Corsa Ferrari. The 21 machine tried several times to get in front of the Germans' Mercedes and to no avail. But now the Ferrari enjoys, well, half a second. So the question is he actually ahead of him on the track? Because a number of times they've been through the tri-oval, Serra's been scored as the leader, and then you look again to the infield and it's still the Mercedes in front. It might be that scenario again, quite frankly, but I can only tell you how the timing screen's telling me. 21 leads, 57. Andrea Caldarelli for the Lamborghini Huracan is in third, car 1, ahead of Trent Hindman for Wright Motorsports and a Porsche number 16 fourth, and Laurens Vanthoor also for Porsche, and this time for Pfaff Motorsports in fifth. That's the latest Mazda in-race update, and there are another 6 hours to go here on RS2 IMSA Radio.